Blog Talk Radio.
Excellent. Glad you're on.
Good, good. Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
so
been a while.
Glad you're on, Mark. This is just wonderful. You've been looking forward to it. I was all busy about to make a promo vid yesterday, and I looked at YouTube, and I'd already made one.
Yeah, I know. There was one for last time when we were going to do it, weren't we?
November. And I looked at it, and I thought, oh, man, the date's wrong, the number's wrong, and... Then I started thinking about it, and I thought, I've got so much to do. If I mess around, I'm going to get all flustered, and I'm not going to concentrate. So then I thought, that's okay. We'll do the show. And then when we do radio portraits and Rick has done his drawing, then I'll put that in a new promo bid. I was like, okay, now I got it figured out. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much. It's great. Yeah, it's great to speak to you, and, you know, I've been really excited and looking forward to this, so, yeah, it's cool.
So what have you been up to?
Me? Oh, God, yeah. I've been really, it's been mad, really. I've been very busy. I'm working on stuff for a new exhibition. I'm designing a range of T-shirts. I'm starting on a book, all kinds of stuff, really. And still doing the Bowie masks, which are kind of still on the go at the moment. So yeah, I've been incredibly busy, really. And
wanted to ask you a question, Mark. If you wouldn't mind, I got fascinated when I was doing the research. I don't know if I had a chance to tell you this, Rick, because you've been so busy, you know, dog walking and important stuff in the mountains. Mark, I was all fascinated because I caught wind of a remark that you made on your website about you and Boy George doing an exhibition up in Merseyside. And then I went back and I thought, now, wait a minute. Mark's from Liverpool or Merseyside. I know he's from up here. So then it started to dawn on me, all of this wonderful contact, this way that you are linked to Liverpool and Merseyside. Oh, please talk to us a little about what that was like, you know, as when you were, you know, going to college and coming up as a young artist.
Yeah, okay. Well, the weird thing is that I've been obviously living in London for many, many years and kind of got drawn back to Liverpool through an organization called Homotopia, which is an arts organization up there. And so I started exhibiting up there because I hadn't really exhibited there over the years. So that's how I ended up doing the exhibition with Boy George up there, the joint exhibition we did together. But yeah, I'm originally from a place called New Brighton, which is a seaside place opposite, on the other side of the river, really, to Liverpool. And when I was a teenager and a kid, it was still a big sort of fairground kind of area. And so all my summer jobs were on the pier, in the arcade, amusement arcades, whatever. And I first heard of David Bowie, actually, when I was working on the pier in New Brighton selling rock and seaside tap. And I overheard two teddy boys who were waiting at the tea stall to buy their tea talking about a gig that they'd recently seen at the Liverpool Stadium of this outrageous singer who was half man, half woman, wore spacesuits and makeup on stage. And that was the first time I'd heard of David Bowie. And, of course, my radar went, you know, sort of into overdrive. And I thought, I need to find out who this is. And went off and sort of discovered the whole Bowie thing, which kind of took over my life. But it was great growing up in a kind of seaside place, because that was the kind of summer of glam rock and all of that. So all the fairgrounds and everything were full of that sort of music. And then, of course, I went to art school up there. But back then, pre-computers and everything, one kind of, if you wanted to do something, if you wanted to be involved in the arts, really, then you had to come to London. So I was kind of, I kind of wanted to escape. I think when you're young, you want to escape from the provinces and you want to get to cities where it's all happening. So,
of course, exactly.
Yeah, you know, that's what it's about. When you just really want to escape. So as soon as I finished art school, I kind of headed straight for London and gravitated towards the Blitz club scene and all of that, which is where I met people like Boy George and Steve Strange and all of that. And realized that I'd discovered the actual, you know, I'd been obsessed with doing paintings of David Bowie and you, Angie, as well, obviously. because you were such an iconic couple, you know, you really were very iconic. And I remember when I was back when I was at school in 73, on the kind of the year when Bowie really kind of exploded in Britain, all the Bowie boys at school all wanted the greatest prize they could get was to have an Angie lookalike girlfriend. and they did. And they did, because the look was, you know, the bleached hair, the no eyebrows, the pedal pusher trousers, the striped top, whatever. And a lot of these Bowie boys had Angie lookalike girlfriends. So you were like a real big part of that whole thing as well. So, as I said, when I came to London and discovered the Blitz Club and realized there were people who were actually taking the Bowie ethos and creating their own identities, I realized that's where I discovered my subject, really, my, you know, what my art was about.
I need to just say right now, Mark Wardell is the most remarkable artist. Now, I got a backstory on this, Mark, which I thought would make you laugh.
Yeah, cool.
When Alan Yentob was doing Cracked Actor, who later became the director of the BBC, he told David that he was going to do the Death Mask.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
And I, being a very superstitious Greek, was horrified. I felt like it was Dancing with the Devil. You know what I mean? They had asked me at Madame Tussauds if they could make my likeness and if they could put it in shop windows. And I said no. Because I was,
you know what I
mean? I had this superstition
about
it.
I know.
So then anyway, David did it, and afterwards he said to me, he came out, he started laughing, he said, I thought you were silly, with all your superstition, but when they stuck the straws up my nose and the plaster started to harden, I panicked. And let me tell you, Ange, I wish I'd listened to you. And I was laughing. I said, oh, it's great. You've done it now. You know what I mean? It's done. I said, that was just me being silly. I was trying to spin it, you know. And so then this incredible artist, Mark Wardell, is invited by the Victoria and Alba Museum when they do this big retrospective exhibition, Rick, and all of our listeners, to make this amazing series of masks of David. And Mark, please, pick up the story. Regale us, please. Tell us the whole thing from beginning to end. I am so excited to hear it from your mouth.
Okay. Well, I mean, the weird thing is it kind of happened by accident because I never intended to be a mask maker or to be kind of get well known for actually making masks. But as part of the whole, you and David Bowie were sort of main influences on my art. So when a friend of mine in the music industry got hold of a cast of David Bowie from which was made, I don't think it's the Cracked Actor one. I think it was from the year after when he was doing The Man of Hell's Worth, but I'm not exactly sure, but it's kind of around that time. And he actually lent it to me to make a copy of. So what I did, I made a new mold from it, and then I kind of smoothed it off and kind of perfected it slightly where there were, you know, it didn't really go very far back, so I sort of built it up at the sides and things like that. And I was just doing it for myself, really, and casting some off and not really doing anything much with them. And I was lucky enough to be invited to the opening of the David Bowie Is exhibition and saw that they had some life casts of Bowie on sale from somebody had made from an 80s cast, and everyone was saying to me, oh, it's not as good as yours, it doesn't look as glamorous everything, whatever.
Which is
why
nice.
Don't you, so they said, why don't you send a picture of yours to the V&A? So I actually thought, oh, well, they're probably not, you know, I might as well, but, you know, I probably won't hear anything back. But they sort of emailed me back within a couple of hours and said, you know, can you come in and see us? So I went in and they initially said they wanted 50, which I was kind of thinking, oh my God, because I didn't really know how to make like large quantities of them or anything like that. I only made a few. So I went home and they emailed me later and they changed the 50 to an order for 300. So that kind of started my mask making process. So really, for, you know, a large part of that year, I was just really making these David Bowie masks. And then, of course, once the edition had finished, people still wanted to buy them. So I started experimenting with, like, variations and doing makeup and some of the iconic makeups and things, like the Pierre LaRoche Aladdin Sane makeup and all that kind of thing.
Yes, yes.
And which people really liked as well. And somehow David Bowie and his people picked up on this and approached me to say that they would like to buy two for his official archive, which I was very pleased to do. So it was nice to basically get the David Bowie seal of approval for it.
Absolutely.
It obviously meant that he obviously must have liked what I was doing and had kind of, you know, appreciated it and everything rather than, you know, had a negative reaction. So that was how that kind of started, really.
Amazing.
I just think it's such a wonderful story. And so they're very striking. It's an amazing collection. I think the V&A was so very clever to jump on you and grab you. You know, like, please do this. You know?
It was great.
It's a win-win story.
And it's great. And it's obviously, for an artist, it's great to be, you know, that somebody like the V&A should be kind of, you know, into your work as well, you know, because obviously it's a very prestigious organization. So, you know, it's nice kudos, you know, to actually have that, you know, that that kind of thing happening.
Yes.
Mm.
Well, could I kind of, would you like tell us the story of how things happened, if you don't mind, if I'm not being too nosy, but tell us. I'm a big fan of Boy George, a huge fan. Absolutely adore him, and I would love to hear. I read the stuff on your website and everything, but I'd love to hear you tell us the story of how that all happened, including, you know, the exhibition up in the Liverpool area.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I've known, as I say, when I came to London, I gravitated towards the Blitz Club, and got to, as soon as I set eyes on Steve Strange and Boy George, you know, they were the most incredible looking people that I'd ever seen, because, you know, the looks that they did were kind of literally traffic stopping. I mean, even the way they would look in the daytime. You'd see cars almost screeching to a halt in the streets, you know, and then at night, kind of ramped up even further. You know, they really were taking the whole kind of Bowie ethos into sort of ramping it up. So I actually got friendly with George, who was actually the coat check girl at the Blitz at the time. So he was kind of taking the coats and everything, but looking
perfect.
Like a kind of, looking like a kind of space kabuki vision with kind of 2 foot vertical hair and parrot with parrots in it and all kind of, I mean, the look was just unbelievable. And so I said to him, you know, I'd like to paint your portrait, which he was very up for. So George was the first portrait of an actual person that I knew that I'd painted. And he said he said recently that it made him feel like a star, you know, long before he was, because it wasn't sort of the sort of thing that, you know, people weren't painting your portrait every day back then.
That's right.
Yeah. So that was the start of it. And I've realized George and I have had like kind of a working friendship right since then. You know, we worked together on a lot of different projects. I've done artwork for T-shirts for George, and we exhibited together in the exhibition in Liverpool as well for the Homotopia thing. So we have this kind of friendship, but it's a working friendship, and whenever we get together, it's always there's always a work reason involved. So we don't sort of hang out together or stuff like that, but whenever we get together, it's always for a work thing. And George is got an incredible work ethos. He's always got loads of projects on the go, and he's always working on loads of different things. So he's a very we bounce off each other, you know, ideas wise very well and everything, and work together very well. So Homotopia were having their 10th birthday 3 years ago now, and they wanted to do something special for the 10th birthday. So they asked if George and I would do a joint exhibition. So that's what we did, basically, because George is a very good photographer. He takes great photographs. So we were kind of exploring.
Perfect.
Yeah. So what we were doing was that the whole thing was, again, inspired by the whole Bowie ethos, coming back to David Bowie and you, Angie, because George is obviously a huge Bowie person as well. We're both kind of the children of Ziggy Stardust generation, you know. And went to, you know, George always says, you know, he went to the school of Bowie, and so did I, because that's where we picked up all our cultural clues and our stylistic aesthetic sense and everything from. So we're both sort of working from the same, coming from the same sort of starting point. So the exhibition we did was my paintings of based on the idea of invented personalities and personas, self-invented personas, and George's photographs along the same line. So George would come up with a character name like No Money Campbell or Jumping Jack Trash, these fantasy characters that didn't exist. I'd do my interpretation of them in painting form, and he would do his interpretation of them in photographic form. And so that's how the exhibition sort of worked. And it, and
wow.
the work actually went together very well, I have to say. You know,
I
really
like it.
Sounds absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, it, yes, it was. It worked very well, and that's also the I included the painting of you in it, Angie, with the where I put your I hope you didn't mind I put your head onto the body of a guy because it
oh,
was
no,
about
I love that one.
Well, it was about
I love
the
that one.
Oh, good. It was exploring
now, I told
kind
you
of
what
a,
I thought we would do. Is this okay, guys? I thought this
yeah.
would be very appropriate. We're going to take a musical interlude with Dana Gillespie. Move your body close to me.
Right.
Move your body close to me. Move your body close to me. Touch heart to heart, don't ever part. Oh, give in. Move your body close to me. Body close to me, reach out to feel that it's for real. Oh, give in, move your body close to me. Oh,
Oh, wasn't that wonderful?
I feel so relaxed. I wanted to play it for you because, David, you know, one of the strangest things that I always think of, thinking about him now, writing this appreciation, number one, I wanted to ask if you would please contribute a testimonial, just, you know, 500 or 600 words if you would like to, because
I'm putting
a chapter in at the end for all of the folks that were influenced by him or have something wonderful to say in memory of him, that so that they're, from what I've gone through and written about all the tracks and the drawings that Rick has done of each line of each track, those first 10 or 12 albums, I just thought that would be a wonderful tribute for all the folks that we've so enjoyed talking with and everything, you know.
Yeah, I think
that would be something.
Great idea.
If you would like
I'd,
to, that would be
I'd
cool.
Be, yeah.
And, sorry.
Of course, I'd be delighted to.
Oh, that would be so nice. Thank you so much. What I was going to say was, is that Dana was the one person who she and David were songwriting students together. That song, when Dana plays this song, she always used to giggle and look at me and raise an eyebrow because she and David, she was 14, David was 16, and they would try out all their new songs on each other. She had the bunker in Thurlow Square where her mother and father lived. Her father was a doctor in London and could afford this wonderful big house in South Kensington. And so she was there, and they would play each other their songs and, you know, support each other at gigs. And it was just, when I first got to meet her, I felt like I was actually seeing a window on his youth. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because, I mean, he was only 22 or 23, but, you know, this was like a lot earlier. This was someone who had known him for 6 or 7 years, and it was exciting.
Wow.
It was fun for me. But anyway, I wanted to share that with you. That's why I played the song.
Yeah, Dana's wonderful. I actually saw her. She did a talk at the V&A, I think, while the Bowie exhibition was on. So I was lucky enough to go along to see her there. And that was very interesting. She's very amusing and interesting, stories to tell about those times, which is completely fascinating for the likes of me who were fascinated from back then, and also for the younger generation who are absolutely fascinated with those times because they didn't live through them. So, I actually think my generation are really lucky because we were teenagers at that time and experienced all that, you know, what a fantastic burst of influence and creativity and music and everything happened back then. And Dana was, you know, part of that. I remember, you know, she was... We knew her as a main man artist, you know. I remember that.
Yeah.
You know, all those posters. Yeah, amazing vision.
Toured her all over Europe and England and the States and Canada, actually, for Weren't Born a Man. And so, it is. She is so much a part of it all that I thought that would be appropriate. I hope you didn't mind my putting a track in there. I just thought
I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was great. It was really mellow and nice. And it's a beautiful sunny evening here in London, so it kind of went with the sunny evening vibe.
Perfect.
Yeah, so great.
Now, okay, Mark. Now, Rick, would you do me the favor? You are the professor artist in residence. Would you please, because you know all the terms, and Mark won't become impatient with you. I know when I search for terms, I hate making people have to wait for me to say what I mean. But I want to hear all about the silk screening process and, you know, in artistic and technical terms, because I know Mark has so much to talk about and chat with and maybe impart some knowledge to
I worked as a silkscreen printer for a while just before I went to art school. So it's a process that I absolutely love as well, you know. And actually, my paintings are kind of silk screen. They kind of have a silk screen look to some of them. A lot of people think they are silk screens. Yeah, and
yeah,
even though they're not. So I'm kind of, that's an aesthetic that I like. So yeah, I'm really interested to hear Rick's take on it, on the silk screen thing. Are your silk screens, Rick? Are you doing silk screens with your work?
No, you know what? I've never done silk screens.
Oh, right.
Never.
Okay.
I've been drawn to the process, and there were times I would love to have done them, but I didn't have access to equipment or space or whatever.
Yeah,
it takes a lot of space.
It does, you know, it really does. I'd like to, you know, when I get enough space, I'd like to set up a screen printing situation. But yeah, you're right. You know, it does. It takes up a lot of space.
Mark, explain to me. So that wonderful silk screen look that I was calling out because I wasn't, you know, I just didn't want to sound like a fool or try to sound like I, you know everything when I don't. Is that actually that you just painted?
Yes, it's all painted by hand. Yeah.
Oh, you're so brilliant. How clever of you.
Well, I try, you know. I've had a lot of practice.
I had no idea.
Yeah, no, they're not silk screens. They're actual paintings in oil paint and acrylic. So, but that's the kind of look that I go for. That's kind of my aesthetic, is that kind of silk screened look. And a lot of people do think that they're silk screens. But no, it's all absolutely hand painted, so it's quite labor intensive.
Wow,
I've actually recently started experimenting with doing some spray stencils, because I did the ones with you, Angie, last year. I think if you remember
remember all of it. I had no idea, and I was so excited to interview and chat with you so that I could understand, you know, how you had made this happen.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I mean, it's basically hand-painted stuff, but I started experimenting with stenciling techniques so that you can produce multiples, because you can get a screen-printed, you can get a kind of screen-printed look, and you can do multiples, whereas with the way I normally work, you know, you can't really do multiples because it's very labor-intensive. Yeah, I'm kind of experimenting with that, but I would like to move into doing screen prints as well, because as I said, I did do some screen printing years ago, which is probably where part of that aesthetic comes from, I guess.
Well, it's a beautiful thing, and I mention it because I'm constantly with Rick. I used to, when I first saw his work, he did a lot of black and white, and it always used to bring me back to Lino Bloch. I was very lucky, you know, I went to school in Switzerland, and I had the most amazing art teacher who taught me history of art and also did all of our actual art classes. But that Lino Bloch and silkscreen, which we did not have room for either, but one of the schools nearby did, and so they would go and do that. But I was much more about the art appreciation, because the Impressionist exhibition was in Lausanne in 1964, and we had the opportunity of seeing 200 Impressionist canvases, which was the biggest Impressionist exhibition ever assembled.
Yes.
And I was there doing a show called Barberine. We were in the drama company, and so we got a chance to go to the exhibition every day for a week. And needless to say, we all got A's for A-level art appreciation. The point being that all of these wonderful methods that you're talking about, see, what you're bringing about is this great crossover of how you painted what was a look that was silk screened. Now, how does that reflect, Mark, when you think about it in terms of technology and computers and digitizing? Is there a point where your brain seeps into that technological, is it an ability or an abyss?
I think it could be both. I think it can be both. I'm kind of a big fan of, hands-on process and actually creating with the hands and actually having a physical object there. And I do find a lot of computer art and everything, it's kind of a bit too, for somehow, for me, it doesn't quite, I like an object. I like to create something that actually exists in a, in, even though it's a flat painting, it exists in a 3D space. So,
yes.
While I'm, and also I think what I find, I have a terrible problem if I have too much choice. And so if I could change my paintings at the press of a mouse, I would never get anything done because there's just too much possibility. The possibilities are just too endless. And I find that thing of endless possibilities and endless choice kind of stifles creativity in a way. I kind of like to challenge myself to have to commit to something. It's like, when is a painting actually finished? Do you know what I mean? You have to,
yeah.
It has to be a cutoff point. Having said that, you know, it can be, technology can be a great tool, you know, to use. It depends how you use it. But I'm a kind of hands-on artist. I like to get my hands dirty with paint and whatever, you know. I still really enjoy the whole process of putting paint on canvas. I just find it so satisfying on every level, really. And actually, Rick, I was going to say with your work, it always puts me in mind of a lot of the coloured ones, of kind of stained glass windows in a way. I was just wondering if you'd ever translated any of your work to stained glass, because it'd just be so cool to see one of your designs stained glass window, wouldn't it?
I've never worked with stained glass. However, in Boston, when I was in art school, I had a roommate who was this Hasidic man who was working with stained glass through the Museum of Fine Arts, and my other roommate was a young man who was a musicologist and composer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there was me with my black leather jacket with my girlfriends, and it was quite the scene. But I did do some drawings that I interpreted for the man who was working for with stained glass, which was interesting to think of, you know, shapes emitting light. Yeah, I would love to see some of my work in stained glass.
Mm. Oh, cool. Yeah, I think I could really see it. I quite often think of that, you know, as I see your drawings coming up on online all the time, because you're incredibly prolific. It it makes me feel, God, I've got to get more done. You know, I need to get more. need to get more done.
I honestly just use every free moment I have to draw.
Good.
Actually,
well, that's
yeah,
good.
And
yeah.
I make a point of getting up very early, like 3-ish. And I draw like 4 or 5 hours before my day starts.
Right, okay. Well,
now,
you know,
Mark,
what, fueled by coffee?
I'm all excited. I want, please give us the full, I'm all excited to hear about this exhibition that you're preparing for.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, it's, again, it's Liverpool, strangely enough. It's the Liverpool Biennale this year. And so there's a lot of art events in Liverpool. And what I'm doing, I've got an amazing gallery up there, a big gallery space. And what I'm doing is it's a one-man show. And it's basically what I'm doing, I'm creating a mood. It's there is a Bowie-ish connection. I've started experimenting with the cut-ups technique, which is the William Burroughs technique that Bowie used on his lyrics and everything. And I'm applying it to my drawings and paintings and coming up with kind of mutations and distortions and things like that. So
very
the whole
nice.
Show is, yeah, it's really exciting. So the whole show is going to be new work, and it's good. Whereas in the past I've been kind of vaguely known for doing a lot of celebrity kind of work that was kind of influenced by celebrities or whatever. This is all kind of... I'm over celebrities now. I'm kind of getting excited about the anonymous. So I'm incorporating some stenciling techniques so that I can do multiples. So there's going to be lots of kind of armies of clone-like figures and anonymous figures and things like that. So it's going to be something quite different from what I've done before. So yeah, it's quite exciting.
It sounds like you're taking your search for identity into the wild world of cloning this year.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean it's
ooh,
kind of.
Oh, you are so sneaky! I love you.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, it's the strange thing is getting into this whole coming back to the mask thing. By getting involved in doing these masks, it made me realize that my work has always been about masks from the start, whether cosmetic masks or physical masks.
Whatever
people,
type, yes.
Yeah, people who were creating their self-created personas through cosmetics or masks, whatever, that was what I was attracted to. So although I didn't really know it, I was kind of, my work was about masks all this time anyway. And it was masks, but filtered through a kind of celebrity culture. And now what I'm doing, I'm taking it out of that celebrity culture and taking it into the kind of cloning and a dystopian kind of area of anonymous armies of people or mutations and things like that. But it's all related to each other. It all leads back and comes from the same sort of starting point.
Yes.
So there is really a connection. Even though the work probably will look quite different, there is still a lot of connections to everything that I've always done as well. So
yeah.
So there is a link there. It's not like I've just branched off into doing something completely different.
It is the orgy of organic, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It is. It's very, very blissful. This is very clever and very smart you are. I love this.
Oh, good. Well,
it's great, isn't it, Rick? I mean,
it's wonderful. I think what Mark's doing is fantastic.
Me too.
Well, I'm very excited by it. You know, it's it's the only thing I can do. So. It's the only thing that I would be, you know, like most creative people, I'm useless at a lot of other things. So luckily, you know, I still really enjoy, I'm still really excited by doing it. So I guess you are as well, Rick, with your work, you know, because the other thing is, I think as creative people, we're never satisfied. So I think that's what keeps you going, because, I'm never satisfied with anything I do. It's great when other people sort of say that they really like it, but you're never actually satisfied with what you've done. So you want to move on and do something more and kind of, you know, do it better next time. And I think that's what, I don't know if that's how you feel about your work.
Well, sometimes I'm amazed that, you know, I'll create something that is kind of lukewarm to me. It's kind of like, you know, and I'll put it out there anyways. And, you know, 75 people will like it, and I'm like, wow. You know, I'm like totally surprised when that happens, because
there's also the thing of with old work as well. Sometimes if an old picture of mine surfaces from somewhere that I haven't seen for a long time, that I didn't really like at the time or appreciate at the time, you can see it through fresh eyes, and you think,
right,
yeah, actually, that looks really good, you know. But strangely enough, I hated
that's
it
right.
at the time, isn't it? Yeah, it's odd
the way
that happens.
Well, I got so excited and also disappointed when I was looking at your FB page, because that you had changed some of the photos or they had moved their position, and I was like, oh, now where's that one of there was one of a young guy that was kind of red and black that I thought was very charming, you know. And
right.
I kept looking for different ones, and I think you have a gift, Mark, of making those memorable, because you have this work ethic of being hands-on and wanting to deliver something that has your taste and your sweat in it. You know what I mean?
No, I was just going to say, I think what we do is we channel our kind of obsessions and our aesthetics into into what we do. So that's where it kind of that's where it all comes out as. You know, it's filtered through, really. It's all the influences that we have put together and filtered through. But what I kind of I had a background in doing a lot of work for club flyers and things back in the 90s, and so that whole thing was creating iconic images, really, for sort of people to almost like modern icons, really. So there's a lot, there's kind of an element of iconography in what I do as well. So that's kind of part of that whole thing.
Yes, I noticed with your posters, you have handy grasp of the anti-Nazi propaganda coloring.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the way those colorways went. I was very impressed by that.
Oh, good. Yeah, I was very, one of my main influences is kind of is that whole sort of anti-Nazi thing and the Soviet propaganda and all of that sort of look as well. With that's a big influence on what I do as well, along with everything else. So yeah, that kind of comes out in all of that. So I'm glad that you picked up on that, because that's something that that, you know, is quite a big part of what I do as well.
Well, I found it very impressive. I just wanted to give you kudos and let you know that all of that thinking and being an intellectual and a hands-on artist really pays you back a thousandfold, Mark, because the work just speaks for itself, doesn't it, Rick?
Yes, it does. Yep.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That's great. That's nice to hear.
No, I was so embarrassed and impressed and happy with that one you showed me that you have done of me. I didn't know what to say. I was totally flabbergasted, you know. I had no words.
I thought they were great.
The multiples ones.
Yeah, and I don't have any of them now because my computer crashed in London. So,
oh, no.
Yeah,
I'll have to send,
please, if you would, because when I wanted to make the promo bit, I didn't finish explaining. I had no images. My whole library of images was gone, and I thought,
This is the problem. This is the problem with computers, isn't it? You know, you can lose.
Yes.
You can lose everything. Whereas if you've got stuff on paper or canvas, it's more, you know, it's a different thing.
That's right. Absolutely. You are so right on about it. It is. It's a different way, not only of recalling and remembering, but of safeguarding the actual work,
exactly.
Isn't it? It's like, I couldn't agree more. I wanted to. So, what else is there, Mark, that you have been noticing? I noticed one of the questions I always like to ask folks is, you know, like I was just in London and with you guys there and enjoying it and just.
I know you made a big impression in London. Well, in the whole of the UK, you know, it's, you were everywhere. I mean, it was unbelievable. And
I know. It was odd, wasn't it? It was like I wasn't there, and then the next minute I was there.
It was incredible. And I mean, everybody was watching you on Big Brother. People who say to me, oh, you know, I would never watch anything like that, whatever. People that would say they would never watch it, everybody was watching it to because you were on there. It was incredible, really.
It was bizarre, wasn't it? I really didn't know how to act. And then this terrible news that came. I went in there on the 5th, and on the 11th, so 6 days later, David passed. I
know.
It was just, I don't know what to say about it.
It must have been incredibly difficult situation to be in. You know, I can't imagine what it must have been like, actually, because it was insane out here, you know, outside the house. I mean, it was just, I've never really seen anything like it. But it was kind of beyond sort of I remember when Elvis Presley died, it was kind of mad, whatever. And this was kind of almost, in this country, it was beyond the Elvis thing. It was just
right.
Extraordinary. It was extraordinary. And it was strange that you were kind of here, but you weren't, because you were kind of isolated as well. So it was very odd, really. It was very odd.
Yeah, I couldn't quite figure out. I felt terrible, you know. I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to intrude on his new family's grief.
Mm. Yeah.
But then I thought, well, I have a son with him, and we spent 12 years having a blast.
Yeah.
So
you've
I guess
got a
I'm
right
feeling
to,
badly, you know, because I really missed him, and because even though we didn't get along sometimes, he was always there. I never thought he was going to die before me. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
He was always there. My mom and dad are gone. I'm all alone. The only person who's known me longer than Michael, my husband, is David and Chico.
Yeah.
Lee's dead.
I know.
Sorry.
I didn't mean to get... No. Please go ahead. It's very strange, isn't it? So, like you were saying, I mean, for you, obviously, it's a completely different sphere. But even for someone like me, Bowie was kind of a constant presence and a big presence in my life for three quarters of my whole life, really. You know, someone that whose music you were into and who influenced you and put you onto. All of the people we knew about, you know, Iggy Pop, Lou Reed, Lee Black Childers, William Burroughs, you know, Jean Genet, all these people were people that we were taught about by David Bowie. And to suddenly for that person to physically not be here, but paradoxically they're kind of here more than ever, because everywhere you look at, you know, there's Bowie on every magazine cover. It's very weird,
exactly.
That double thing, isn't it? They're physically not here, but they're more present than ever. So it's very odd.
Yeah.
Very difficult to process.
Yeah, it was. And it was like this enormous relief, because I didn't have to stand my ground anymore. Now there was nothing to be upset about. I just remembered everything good. Everything good. Every great time we had. All our dreams, all of the things we dreamt of accomplishing. It was like I was unburdened. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was the most bizarre thing.
And you did accomplish so much, you know, together as well, you know, which is, you know, it's a big body of stuff that you were involved with and everything. So, you know, all of those kind of images that we see and whatever, you're kind of embodied in them as well.
I didn't think about that, but you're right. There is a lot of stuff that comes to mind from those days. From, you know, and so many other people too. You know, Mark Bolan and Lou Reed and Slade. I saw a picture of Slade this morning, and I thought how totally cool they were with those great football songs. And everyone stopped picking on gay people because they realized. Everyone's the same. It's just what makes you feel a good sex way. You know, it's no big deal.
No, I was going to tell you that a friend of mine lives in Soho, right opposite Trident Studios. And so whenever I go to visit her, which is kind of every time I'm in Soho, which is all the time, really. So I kind of always focus on things like the paving stones, and I think that crack was there in 1972, and all the people who must have actually stepped on the actual spot. And it's quite weird to focus on those minutiae rather than a kind of macrocosm. It's like a minute thing to focus on, and you kind of think it's very weird that paving stone just there has been stepped on by David Bowie, Angie Bowie, Mott the Hoople, Lou Reed, you know, Iggy Pop, have all stepped on that very spot, and it's still there. It's very odd, isn't it, that whole...
Do you know how alike we are? This is so bizarre. I cannot believe you just said that. I had to go to that place, whatever it's called, that club on Dean Street. I can't remember it, the Groucho Club or the something club. Anyway, it's a club. And so Ann's Court was there, and I was early. I had to go to lunch. Mm-hmm. So I popped into St. Ann's Court, and I walked along, and I got to the door for Trident, and I looked to see if it was, you know, if they still had a suite there. And they did, and I stood there, and I rang the bell about 8 times, and I went, I'm here for a session.
What did they say? Did they cut?
No one came. No one was there.
God. They missed an opportunity there.
It was crazy. You know, I felt like a small child. I just started ringing the bell. I thought, oh yes, hello.
Fantastic.
And then I thought, Angie, come on, go to lunch. Stop being childish.
Oh, no, it would have been so great if they'd cut, because I think it's still some kind of studio or something. It would have been so great if they'd come and...
Suite.
Right.
Yeah, it looked like, I mean, they had, I think there were 4 or 5 other businesses, so they probably had, you know, half the floor or something.
It's funny, isn't it? You know, those kind of things, I kind of think a lot is encapsulated in those tiny details of things from years ago rather than kind of the big picture. You know, you can see a paving stone or a brick or a doorway. You know, I mean, I go past places I used to live, because I always used to live in central London, which one could actually up until, you know. In those days, you know, I lived through the 80s and 90s in central London. And obviously I can't afford to live there anymore because I'm not a Russian millionaire or whatever, but you go past the places you used to live, and you look at the kind of paving stones and things, and it's very odd. I find that very, it always kind of affects me quite a lot, things like that. It's quite strange.
I bet.
But I blame Madonna for kicking me out, because as my lease was expiring in Marble Arch, where I was renting a fantastic apartment, Madonna bought the house 2 doors down. So you can imagine what my landlords wanted to...
expectation. His expectation went out the window.
Yeah, of course you can stay. We're just going to triple your rent and make you sign all these bizarre things and... make you pay this huge deposit even though you've been there 8 years and all of that.
Which is basically unkind.
Yeah, basically get lost. You know, so I was blaming Madonna for kicking me out, actually, as the West End. It's her fault. But anyway, I'm in East London now with all the artists, so you know, it's still really cool, actually. So
I can't really complain. Now, Mark, I can't believe this. I mean, where does an hour go? I've got 2 minutes left, my friend. Please tell everyone when the exhibition's going to be, where they can get a hold of you.
Okay.
And the website, trademarkart.com.
Okay.
But please, feel free. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the exhibition is called Wild Mutation, and it's at the gallery in Stanhope Street in Liverpool. It opens on the 8th of July till the 24th of July. My website is www.trademarkart.com. On Facebook as Mark Wardell. There's lots more to come. I'm launching a T-shirt range and writing a book and all kinds of stuff. So we've got more to talk about maybe another time. It's been great fun, though, and fantastic speaking to you. And Rick, so where's the hour gone? It's amazing.
I can't wait for you to come back, right, Rick? I mean, I know we're going to have thousands new topics.
it was great.
Let's do this again.
Absolutely.
It's fun, isn't it? It's not a big deal. It's just us having a good old chat, right? A chinwag.
That's what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know. Perfect.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure.
I can't thank you enough, Mark. Well, I can't thank you either. It's wonderful to to chat with you and Rick finally after, because I kind of, you kind of feel like you know people through being online, but it's kind of a whole different thing, you know, when you actually, you can actually talk, you know, in the physical realm.
Yeah,
even
exactly.
Even though it's through technology as well, but you know, I feel like we're a bit closer to each other than we were.
Yep.
Absolutely. And now, Rick, you remember when this started? What Mark just said is the reason it started. You remember Elaine Brown said, "Oh, it's always so nice to see everyone who I recognize online. Wouldn't it be nice if we could chat?" And then Rick. I said to Rick, is that someone saying we should do a radio show?
And you've done it.
And then I started it, and then Rick, a couple of weeks later, I said, will you be a co-host? And he said, sure. So, Mark, you were absolutely right. It's like sometimes technology gives us the means to fulfill the function. You're absolutely correct. It does.
It's got some really great positive points to it, which has brought us to this positive point, which is fantastic.
It is, and we love you, and I can't wait, and I hope I'm back in England so I can
cheer you on.
I can't wait to come to the exhibition.
Well, please let me know when you're coming back, because, you know, it'd be great to hook up and meet up. There's so many people that actually want to meet you that didn't get the chance.
Yeah, well, we've got to do it. Let's do it.
Excellent. I look forward to
all
it.
Right.
And you as well, Rick.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you too.
Bye, Mark. Bye, bye, Rick.
Bye, Angie. Bye, Rick. Bye from London. Have the rest of your day good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Mark Wardell, great artist.
Thank you, Angie and Mark. Glad you came back, Mark.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Yes, and don't be a stranger. We're going to make sure we get to chat with you lots, Mark.
Excellent. I can have a regular spot. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Bye.